This is NEPR News Now, a podcast from New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts. I'm Sam Hutzik. We put together a series of short, pocket-sized debates to help Massachusetts voters make their decisions on Election Day. There are also a couple of ballot questions in Connecticut that we'll get into. But first up, a Massachusetts ballot question about hospitals and patients and nurses. Question one, if passed, would limit how many patients could be assigned to each registered nurse in Massachusetts hospitals and certain other healthcare facilities, depending on the unit and level of care. In this debate, we had Patty Healy. She's a registered nurse and member of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which supports the ballot question. And in opposition, we heard from Angela Belmont, chief nursing officer with Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier was the moderator.
We flipped a coin to see who will go first. It was Patty who won the coin toss. So, Patty, I'll give you the first question. Just tell us, why are more strict nurse-to-patient ratios necessary in Massachusetts?
Well, Adam, across the country, hospitals have understaffed their nursing units, and that includes Massachusetts. And for many, many years, the nurses in Massachusetts have been trying to change this to make it safer, to make the workload better, so that we can deliver the high standard of care in every hospital in Massachusetts. And so we have done this ballot initiative after many attempts with the legislature and through our union contracts to get a limit on how many patients nurses take care of. And that's why we're here today. We think this is the best way, after all these years, to actually go to the public and have the public understand how unsafe the hospitals can be without safe staffing.
And Angela, why is question one not necessary?
I don't believe question one is necessary because, first of all, there aren't enough nurses in Massachusetts to even fill this ratio. Currently, we have a deficit of 1,200 RNs in Massachusetts, and if this ballot passes, it would mean that we would need about 5,000 nurses. I don't know where they would come from, and I don't know what the outcome would be in relationship to the quality of care because it did not improve quality of care in California, and I don't believe it will either in Massachusetts.
California is the only other state to mandate nurse-to-patient ratios by law. Angela, I'll let you go first this time. What can Massachusetts learn from that example?
Well, in California, their ratios have not shown, as I said, any improvement in the quality of care for patients. And quite frankly, if you look at the nursing-sensitive quality indicators, Massachusetts scores higher than California currently without the ratios, even though California has them in place.
Patty?
Well, I think the Mass Hospital Association and the hospitals have been grossly deceitful in giving out this kind of information. There are 8 peer-reviewed studies over the past 8 years in California that show that outcomes have improved, cost has gone down, and the emergency room wait times have decreased. There have been clear changes. There are studies. I actually gave the copies of the studies, of the abstracts, to Cooley Dickinson administrator last night. So, number one, it's absolutely not true that it hasn't worked in California. It has. And the medical studies are there to prove it. But there have also been nationwide studies on the nurse staffing and how it affects patient care. And they have come out conclusively showing that patient care will improve.
There have been a wide range of cost estimates on the price tag to implement question one if it's passed. A study from a Boston College professor puts the cost at about $35 to $46 million. The hospital industry cites another study that puts the price tag around $1 billion. And the state commission sees this as about a $600 to $900 million proposition. Patty, I'll let you go first this time. What do you expect voters to do when confronted with such a wide range of cost estimates?
Well, I think that there's been a fair amount of misinformation put out. And this Health Policy Commission study, which I did read, also states that that includes a 4 to 6% raise for every nurse. And what it used as a figure for each nurse is $300,000 per nurse. It doesn't cost that much to hire a nurse. The figures are wildly inflated. And so consequently, we don't believe it.
Angela?
So the Health Policy Commission came out with that cost estimate, and it's related to detailed staffing data. You know, the $47 million that is projected is from the other side is that it doesn't use publicly available staffing data, nor does it include the psych hospitals, ORs, maternities, post-acute beds, pediatrics, or rehabs, and it also ignores the implementation of an acuity tool. So I think that the Health Policy Commission, as an independent study, is likely to be the most conclusive cost to Massachusetts.
Angela, several hospitals and health centers have gone on record as saying services would be impacted, including in some cases a reduction of emergency room capacity or closure. If this passes, what do you think?
I think what this will do is limit access to care. I think that it will force closure of many community programs and extend wait times in our emergency departments. It will also prohibit patient flow in the hospital, increase boarding times, and force our EMTs to hospital shop to find a hospital that does have the ratios that they need. So I think that when people look at this ballot, they really need to understand the implications of what it's going to do to Massachusetts.
Patty?
Yes, well, in fact, in emergency rooms that are understaffed, they don't move patients through the system from the emergency room into the beds upstairs and the floors because they don't have the nurses to do it. Doesn't make sense to say that having more nurses means that it will be worse to move people around in the hospital. In California, they had a 47% decrease in waiting time 3 years after this bill passed in California. We have in Massachusetts, we are 48th in wait times in the country. All we can do is better by hiring more nurses.
All right. I'd like to give you each about 30 seconds to give us a closing statement. And Angela, since you lost a coin toss, we'll let you go first.
Sure. I think in closing, I'd like to say that this ballot was supposed to be about improving patient care. In California, it has not improved patient care. I don't believe that it will for Massachusetts. I believe that it will deny access to care. I think that we need to be thinking about our community services and how EMTs are going to go to hospitals when patients can't get into the emergency department. So I don't see how this is going to reduce the wait time. So I do think that voting no is in the best interest of Massachusetts.
30 seconds, Patty.
Yes, I think the hospital industry in Massachusetts is a multi-billion-dollar industry that actually has money stashed in the Cayman Islands. And they have enough money to take care of this problem. They have for 20 years. And the nurses who work for these hospitals have been sitting with executives for years trying to convince them to do so.
That was Patty Healy, a nurse and member of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which supports Question 1. And in opposition, we heard from Angela Belmont, chief nursing officer with Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton. Now on to Question 2 in Massachusetts, which is all about money in politics. Question 2 aims to reverse the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. A yes vote would begin a long process that could lead to more limits on political spending and corporate rights. A no vote would keep the status quo. Our short debate included Jeff Clements of People Govern, Not Money. He supports a yes vote. And Paul Craney with the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance wants a no vote. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy hosted this debate.
At its center, this is really about that Citizens United decision. That's the 2010 landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling dealing with regulation of political campaign spending by organizations and corporate personhood. Paul, can you explain how what we have now is working?
Sure. So after 2010, the Supreme Court essentially ruled that Citizens United is the law of the land. And what that basically means is it's a campaign finance law that was clear and fair for everyone. Everyone, meaning individuals, employers, and unions, are able to have as much speech as they would like in elections and campaigns, so long as they don't coordinate with the candidate or the party. That's fair. That's clear. That allows the threshold for everyone to achieve the same amount of voice that they would like. And it's worth preserving. It's our First Amendment right.
Jeff, why are you advocating for change?
Well, because there's a couple of false premises in the notion about what Citizens United meant. We don't have as much free speech as we like. We have now a right to spend as much money as we can to influence the political process. That's not the same as free speech. I think every American has a free speech right, and every American should have a free speech right. What we don't have is, if we have billions of dollars, whether we're corporations, unions, or billionaires, to buy a political system, drown out the voices of other Americans, and corrupt the political process. That's what Citizens United did when it struck down reasonable campaign finance laws that had stood for many, many years, and subsequent cases have done even worse, wiping out state laws that had stood for more than a century.
Paul, ballot question two would create an unpaid nonpartisan commission on limiting political spending and corporate rights. That commission would write up its recommendations in the next year. There would still be several steps for the public and voters to weigh in. What's the harm in getting that discussion started?
So thank you for bringing that up. I mean, anytime you look at campaign finance law, it's so important to look at the details because there's, in theory, then there's in practice. Question two would essentially empower a group of people. In this case, it's very specific. It includes a lot of politicians at the state house. So lawmakers, the governor, the attorney general, and many others. And frankly, some of those folks are Democrats, some are Republicans. But for the most part, in Massachusetts, most people are Democrats that are elected. And that's fine if you're a Democrat. But if you're somewhere that is not a Democrat, if you're someone that's an independent or Republican, you should have concern. Because what you're doing with this question, if you vote yes, is you are empowering a bunch of elected officials to draft restrictions on your free speech. And that's very problematic. Any elected official, Republican, Democrat, or independent, has one goal. It's called self-preservation. Campaign finance law is often used as a weapon to silence opposing views and silence their opposition. And that's unfortunate. And unfortunately, in this case, with question two, you are empowering elected officials at the state house to draft legislation to restrict the public's speech. That should be terrifying for most people when they hear that.
Jeff, you're clearly on the other side of that coin. Government has so many commissions. Citizens United has been hotly debated already by activists, the media, legal experts. Why is there more study needed?
Well, it's not just more study. And I have to correct a mischaracterization about what this law does. It does not empower politicians to draft anything, let alone free speech restrictions. Go to peoplegovern.org. You can read it yourself. What this law does is empower citizens. Every single voter in Massachusetts is eligible to apply to be on the Citizen Commission. The law that if you vote yes on question two will create this volunteer, no cost to the taxpayer, Citizen Commission representing the citizens. It's very clear that it has to have political diversity, demographic diversity. Its intent is to get Democrats, Republicans, independents from the citizenry to serve together to solve a significant problem for this country and this Commonwealth. And that problem is we have existential threats right now to the country from climate catastrophe, $21 trillion in debt, an opioid crisis. We can't solve these problems if our political system is bought and paid for by the same interests that are profiting from the status quo. We need a constitutional amendment to end the corruption of our political system and empower the citizens, not the politicians. The current system favors incumbents.
Paul, you have said that even if someone disagrees with Citizens United, constitutional amendment is a dangerous way about addressing it. The only other option, right, isn't that just the Supreme Court?
Yeah, and the Supreme Court rightly ruled on this case. And the reason why this is dangerous to put the U.S. Constitution because you're discriminating. You're discriminating against certain voices in the political process. Citizens United was clear and fair. It allowed employers, individuals, and unions the same ability to express their points of view as much as they want. There's nothing that's unfair about that. But when you put into the state constitution that there are winners and losers, that's very problematic. That's actually why Citizens United happened, because there was layer after layer of campaign finance law that was used as a weapon to silence some people's point of view and their speech. This ballot question, again, I want to stress, is very important when you look at the details. It argues, you know, and I don't knock Jeff, I think he has very good intentions, but it strips employers and unions of rights, not just in campaign finance law, but even more so. I mean, I'm sitting here with you at your studio. I have no right to come here, neither does the government, say, I want to search your human personnel records, right? You would say to the government, go get yourself a search warrant. There are rights for this organization, just like there's rights for unions to advocate for their employees, just like there's rights for businesses to advocate for the individual employees.
Paul, thank you. We do need to move on. We flipped a coin right before we started. Closing statements first, Paul.
Sure. So Citizens United is a great decision because it empowers people, individuals, and employers to have a voice in the political process. Question two specifically puts your freedom of speech at risk. It allows elected officials at the State House to be the ones that draft restrictions on our speech.
And Jeff.
So for 200 years in this country, we had rights for everybody, equal citizens, an ability to run for office, whether born in a log cabin or a mansion. That's what the American Revolution that started here in Massachusetts is all about. Citizens United is new and radical. What it says is that you have more rights if you have more money. You can buy politicians and buy the elections. That's not the American Revolution. Vote yes on question two to create the Citizen Commission to advance a constitutional amendment to secure rights for all Americans to free speech, put voices of everybody into the political system, and we'll begin to be able to solve problems together again.
We heard there from Jeff Clements of People Govern, Not Money. He supports a yes vote on question two. And Paul Craney with the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance wants a no vote. Okay, one more statewide ballot question in Massachusetts. It's a referendum on a law passed in 2016 by the legislature and signed by Governor Charlie Baker that protects transgender people from discrimination in restaurants, stores, movie theaters, and other public places. The law also requires full access in those places to restrooms and locker rooms consistent with a person's gender identity. A no vote would repeal the law. What's interesting is that opponents to the law got this question on the ballot, but a yes vote would keep the law in place. Our short debate included Matt Wilder with the Yes on Three campaign, and in opposition, Andrew Beckwith, legal analyst for the No on Three campaign. Kari and Jiri of New England Public Radio asked the questions.
Andrew, I will start with you since you helped bring this ballot initiative before voters.
Right.
You have said that the issue is not about discrimination per se, but about privacy and safety. How so?
That's right, because what this law does is it allows any man at any time to enter a woman's restroom, locker room, change facility, homeless shelter, if they claim to identify as male. The way the law is written, it's very broad, next to impossible to enforce. So we're concerned about the privacy issues that that raises. On the discrimination level, the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination said publicly in 2015, as this law is being debated, that they already have the jurisdiction over public accommodations and gender identity cases. So the only legal difference when this law is repealed will be that now bathrooms, locker rooms, places like that will no longer be able to be accessed quite so easily by men of any gender identity, including those who could abuse the law to prey on people.
Matt Wilder?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important for your audience to know that this law is about much more than restrooms and locker rooms. It's about every place that we go every day to live our lives, whether that be the coffee shop or a restaurant or the movie theater, anywhere that's not work, school, or home. And so that's what's really at stake here by repealing this law. It takes away those protections for transgender people in all those spaces that we all take for granted. And so that's why it's so important that people vote yes on three. Specifically to restrooms, I think that Andrew is focusing on something that I think really just hasn't materialized in the 2 years since this law has been in place. In fact, there has been no uptick in incidents of criminal activity since this law went into place. And that's proven by the fact that the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association, more than 50 sexual assault prevention agencies, all are in support of upholding this law. Something tells me that if this law put women and children at risk, they would not support this law.
Well, so look, there was a report on Boston 25 that in Woburn, was it a Target in Woburn, there was a man who tried to get into the stall in a woman's room where there's a 10-year-old girl. And the mother reported it and reported to the police. So we're trying to get the details of that. But that's precisely the type of scenario. How does a biological male enter the women's restroom and not get stopped before he's trying to get into the stall with a 10-year-old girl? That's the type of scenario that this law allows to happen because it tells people, for example, if I was a dad standing outside that bathroom door and I see a man walk into the women's room where my daughter is, if I try and stop that man or even question them, I'm in violation of this law, and I could face up to $50,000 in fines or a year in jail. So what this law does is it silences women, in particular, when they object to a male presence in these intimate spaces.
Matt, does this law increase the likelihood that something bad could happen here?
Absolutely not. In fact, there is a peer-reviewed study out of the University of California Law School that says there is no correlation between uptick in criminal activity when these protections are in place. But to the specific case that Andrew just brought up, I think it's really important for people to know nothing about this law allowed anyone to enter that space. Any criminal activity is still against the law, and people will be arrested and charged as they should be.
So when this law was being debated, there was an attempt to amend it to prohibit registered sex offenders from making use of this law if they identified as female or claimed to identify as female, and the legislature voted that down, which means you can have level 2 and 3 registered sex offenders claiming a female identity and getting access to women's locker rooms, homeless shelters, and places like that. And if anyone objects, again, it's the objector, the parent, the mom, the dad, who is subject to criminal penalties.
That's a bit of a stretch. So there are penalties in the law for sure, but that's for repeated acts of discrimination over several years.
It can be a single act.
Over several years, the law is quite clear. No one has been fined under this law in the 2 years that it has taken place, up to $50,000.
Matt, how do you allay the concerns of people who are afraid or just uncomfortable that their safety is going to be threatened?
Well, first of all, I would say we all care about safety and privacy, particularly in restrooms and locker rooms. I would not advocate for a law that put my niece and nephews at risk, and I don't think anyone who's advocating for this law would do that either. What the facts tell us is that there is no correlation between protecting transgender people in public places and an uptick in criminal activity. There are certainly examples of creeps going into spaces that I think Andrew and I would both agree should not be in there, but this law does not allow that to happen.
Makes it easier for them to do it because it says if anyone objects, the objector is subject to criminal penalties. And we should take the word of Matt's co-chair, Mason Dunn, who helped file a discrimination complaint against a female spa owner who declined to wax the genitals of a man. Now, the man identified as female, and so they filed this claim. And so what their campaign co-chair is trying to do is force female spa workers to wax male genitalia, even though they're uncomfortable with it, or face these fines and penalties. It's outrageous.
Again, that's just not true. The person that Andrew is talking about is a transgender woman who sought a manicure, pedicure.
That's not true.
That is actually true, Andrew, if you read the report.
I read the 5-page handwritten complaint where that man talks about
transgender woman.
He talks about his penis and how he wants it waxed.
We'll have to end it there because,
well, that's
because we've almost run out of time here. I did want to finally just ask you, Andrew Beckwith, this is a law that's already on the books for 2 years. How do we make sure that folks are not discriminated against if the law is repealed?
Sure. We leave it up to the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, which again was clear back in 2015 that they already have jurisdiction over gender identity discrimination claims in public accommodations. So the restaurant, movie theater, those types of places are already covered. The only difference if this law is repealed is that if a male body goes into a female private space, the women have a right to object if it's inappropriate.
And Matt, what are the consequences you see happening if it was repealed?
Well, there are real consequences for transgender people all across Massachusetts. I think when this law was passed 2 years ago by Governor Baker, when he signed it into law, it really was a moment for them that they felt a burden lifted off their shoulders, like the state finally had their back. This is about dignity and respect. That's what this comes down to. And again, you don't have to believe me. You can look at our supporters. The law enforcement leaders in this state and the sexual assault prevention leaders in this state are all voting yes on 3, and we're urging voters to do the same.
That was Matt Wilder with the Yes on 3 campaign and Andrew Beckwith with the No on 3 campaign. Some Massachusetts voters will see other questions on their ballots, but those three are the only ones that are statewide. In Connecticut, 2 ballot questions to amend the state constitution will appear before voters. One is all about money for Connecticut's Special Transportation Fund, a so-called lockbox that's supposed to safeguard money earmarked for transportation so that it can't be raided by the legislature for other uses. If it passes, revenue generated from things like the gas tax and licensing fees would be kept in a lockbox and earmarked solely for transportation projects. So that's about protecting money for transportation. And one more ballot question in Connecticut, question 2, is about protecting land, or more specifically, it's about how the state goes about selling land. And it could have a major impact on the environment and government transparency. Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill has more.
Pamela Adams says there's a way the sale of public land is supposed to work. If legislators want to sell or swap land used for recreation or farming, they raise a bill, and that bill gets a public hearing. At least, that's how it's supposed to go.
But oftentimes, at the end of the session, some of these sales or trades or giveaways are done at the 11th hour. And there was no public hearing on it. In fact, no discussion on it in many cases.
Adams is the co-president of the Friends of Connecticut State Parks. She's speaking with me on the shores of Hammonasset Beach, one of the state's most popular parks. In 2013, legislators did some last-minute tweaks, packing a few lines into a bill to give away a small portion of this land to the town of Madison for free. There was no public hearing.
Our tax dollars go into acquiring these, maintaining these, and to have them given away without any input isn't right.
Eric Hammerling, executive director of the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association, says that's what ballot question number two is all about.
This is a real opportunity to do things with transparency.
Hammerling says ballot question two is long and wordy, but basically boils down to this.
If any state lands are being proposed by the General Assembly to be sold, swapped, or given away, there would have to be a public hearing first.
The amendment would also require two-thirds of both houses of the General Assembly to vote in favor before the legislature could do anything with land owned by the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection or the Department of Agriculture. Past state land deals have caused controversy. The so-called Haddam land swap is one of the best-known examples, a case where legislators proposed exchanging land overlooking the Connecticut River with a commercial developer. That deal fell apart in 2012, but motivated many conservationists to push for the ballot question. Hammerling says legislators tend to prioritize the needs of their districts over those of the entire state, and that with the state's ongoing budget crisis, the temptation to sell off public lands among legislators will only grow.
On page 45, House Calendar 556, Senate Joint Resolution Number 35.
In May, members of Connecticut's General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to place the land use ballot question before voters. But there was dissent. Democrat Rick Lopes from New Britain voted no, saying the question will provoke unintended consequences.
Because of this new language, we're going to need a hearing. Maybe there's not time for a hearing. We're going to need a two-thirds vote, and your issue is going to become a political football.
Bracing against the cold wind on the beach at Hammonasset, Pamela Adams says she doesn't buy that.
If something is a good proposal, then they should have the honesty and the fortitude to stand up in front of everyone and say what it is they would like to do and get their affirmation.
After all, she says, this is the public's land. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Patrick Scahill in Hartford.
There's a lot more on your ballots this fall than those ballot questions. You can read and hear all about Connecticut's election at the websites of our sister stations, WNPR.org and WSHU.org. And for a voter guide for residents of Western Massachusetts, head to NEPR.net. You've been listening to NEPR News Now. Thanks for joining us. To support this podcast and everything that comes out of the New England Public Radio newsroom, please consider making a donation at NEPR.net. Until next time.